This episode is sponsored by Balanced Bridge. Balanced Bridge has been providing cost-friendly capital solutions to professional athletes since 2015. They have dedicated professionals who understand the industry and are ready to customize a repayment plan catered to the athlete's situation and financial objectives. Their platform features no broker fees, a variety of repayment and pricing options, and no prepayment penalties. Whether you or your client are a professional athlete that is looking to invest or make a purchase without having to deplete their cash reserves, or is simply needing a small bridge to support their cash flow through the remainder of the offseason, reach out to Balanced Bridge and let them propose a solution for you. For more information, check out the description. Welcome to A Frugal Athlete Podcast, where we interview athletes, both current and former, on the prudent financial practices and smart career decisions they are making. In these episodes, we dive into what it means to be a frugal athlete. You might think that frugal just means being cheap, but as you will soon learn, being frugal is more complex than that. Hey, what's up? I'm Amobi Okugo, a.k.a. A Frugal Athlete. So check this out. We came out with an all-new, extensive, brand-new course. Our course, Rookie Mistakes, is a course that helps young athletes and individuals avoid the common mistakes when starting your career. I provide real-life examples, lessons, insights, all that and more to teach you how to identify the rookie mistakes before you make them. And trust me, I've made a lot. It's all about giving yourself the best foundation and head start to build financial and career stability. For more information or to get the course, check out the link in bio. Welcome to another episode of A Frugal Athlete Podcast. Today, we got a very special guest. I'm not going to waste any time. Patrick McGinnis, venture capitalist, author, just all around great guy. Someone who's kind of changed my life when it comes to starting a frugal athlete. His book, The 10% Entrepreneur. He has another book as well called FOMO. He's just an all-around game changer. So we're happy to have him on. I know he's a busy man. But Patrick, how you doing today?
Good. How are you?
Nah, doing well. So I remember we talked offline. Like the last time we spoke was a little while ago. But, you know, I feel like we immediately hit it off. But for the people that don't know you, can you give us some context into who you are?
Sure. Yeah, I think we last talked in 2018. It feels like 9,000 years ago in so many ways. In good ways and bad ways in a lot of ways. Sure. So I I started my career on Wall Street, your traditional kind of thing, investment banking and private equity, got an MBA from Harvard. You know, I was just doing my thing and thought everything would be great. And my career blew up in spectacular fashion in 2008. And I realized that you can't rely. There are no safe pathways, you know, in the world. And so I decided to become more self-sufficient and started doing all my own things on the side projects that grew into a bunch of different things that we can talk about today, including a book. And then in the middle of all this, a word that I invented way back in 2003, the word FOMO actually got famous and made it to the dictionary. And so which is crazy. And so
do you have that word trademarked or something? Like, how does it work?
Oh man, don't even get me into this. Basically, like, it's really hard to trademark a word, especially a word that's become so popular. So yeah. I've trademarked, listen, we're in the battle. I'm in it, you know, with the trademark office. So if you're listening, trademark office, love you. But we do have, exactly. We have trademarked FOMO sapiens, which is a term that we have.
And FOMO sapiens, you have a podcast around that as well, right?
I do. I have a podcast called FOMO Sapiens, comes out every Thursday, talks about, we talk to like leaders in business and life. So, you know, everybody from Andrew Yang and Jay Shetty to Gretchen Rubin to CEOs like the founder of Tom's, like Chobani, all these kind of lot of startups. So yeah, we just kind of talk to people about the decisions that they make.
That's amazing. So make sure you guys tune into that every Thursday. We'll have that in the show notes. Always try to plug our guests. But with that being said, obviously, you know, 2008 came. And would you say you were forced to, you know, become self-sufficient, or that was just like, all right, I know now that I can't rely on a job? Because as athletes, you know, one injury away, one coaching decision away, and it's all over. So how did it come about for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's so true, that story of the athlete. And I've talked to a lot of actors too, like folks that are, you know, like I had a woman on my podcast who was like on Blue Bloods on, you know, I don't know what channel, CBS or something. And she talks like the same way as an athlete. You know, it's like, I don't know when my gig is going to be up because, you know, they just, you know, your show gets canceled or whatever. I always was a big believer in being self-reliant. I grew up in a small town in Maine. You know, I don't come from a wealthy family. I all my friends in college, I went to Georgetown, you know, not all of them, but many of them had like, you know, something to fall back on in terms of like you know, they, even if they failed in life, they were going to have, you know, millions, right? That is not my case. My parents gave me everything I needed, but it wasn't like we're just sitting on millions. So I always was a saver. I was raised to save and save and save. And I did save. I saved. I mean, when I got to business school, I could have paid for the whole thing out of pocket. And then I came back and I started saving after business school. And so I was always like, I was always very obsessed with like having money in the bank. Mm-hmm. But then in 2008, when AIG blew up, and our, it was such a disaster. My stock fell 97%. Like the whole company was a mess. Like it was bad. And I just realized it's sort of like, I had been through this once before when the group that I had worked for at JP Morgan was eliminated. And so I was sort of like, okay, two times now you work for major companies worth billions and billions, trillions of dollars. And you did a great job and it didn't matter because your group was eliminated. That's it. Like next time, if this happens, like third time, like it's your fault. You need to find a way to build something for yourself that is yours, no matter what happens at your day job. And that was really the big kind of like, that's when the light went off in my head to mm-hmm. try to figure out a way to diversify myself outside of my day job.
Perfect. So like, how do we start that? Because obviously, you know, from the athlete perspective and, you know, your book, 10% Entrepreneur, going to have that in the show notes as well. I recommend everyone read it. If you're an entrepreneur or not, it's just this, like the mindset shift. So how do you identify, you know, something to create on the side? How do you not let it affect maybe your main income or your main job where people are like, oh, he's distracted or she's distracted or she's not fully engaged? Like, how do you go about those first initial steps to figure out, you know, whether it's right for you?
Sure. And I think what's interesting too, when it comes to athletes in particular, is like the old model for being a professional athlete was like, I'm going to be a pro, I'm going to save some money, then I'm going to like buy a car dealership. And then, you know what I mean? Which is, yeah. By the way, that's totally legit. I'm not poo-pooing that at all. But the new model, and you see people like, I think a great example, I mean, obviously she's like next level, you know, we're not all going to be her, but Serena Williams, you know, she has figured out how to have a career, obviously in her sport where she dominates, but also she's got a venture capital fund. She's been doing lots of deals. So like, she's like, I'm not going to wait. I don't need to wait until the end of my career and then just have all this money saved and then like figure out what to do next. She's yeah. actively looking for opportunities. And so for all of you that are listening, number one, what I'd say is, you know, start thinking now, like what is, you know, 10% entrepreneur, if we define what that is, it's somebody who takes 10% of their time at least, and if possible, 10% of their money and starts investing in things on the side. Now that means, you know, thinking about, okay, putting money away, right? And building a nest egg for yourself, which, you know, is really important. And then, you know, at the same time, thinking about how can I invest those in things that will actually sort of earn me long-term income. So I'm not telling you to buy Bitcoin. You know, that is not what I'm, you may want to do that, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about how can you invest in things that will grow over time and that will, you know, generate income for you over the long run, ownership so you can build wealth. And so, you know, what I recommend people to do is, first of all, think about what they're good at and then think about what they like to do, because the combination of those two is where you're going to be successful. So like Amobi, you're a great example of somebody who's doing this, right? You are a total 10%er. You have come up with an idea for a media company based on what you're good at and what you like to do. You're good at sports and you like to do them. You have a passion for finance and building, you know, sort of personal finance products for people. And so you've combined them into building a business where you're able to build a community that you can monetize. And I know you spent a lot of time on it, but I bet you started out at like 10%. You were able to save money to do that, was within your means. So you started this. And then from that, you can do a bunch of other stuff. I'm sure people approach you all the time. Do you want to get involved in my new project? Do you want to invest in something that I'm doing? And so that's what 10%ers do. We invest, we advise, and we start things on the side. We build a portfolio. I have more than 20 in my portfolio. We do it for the rest of our lives. It's something that becomes part of who we are, and we take it wherever we go. And if something bad happens in our day job, we still have something for ourselves.
Amazing. So talk about your first deal, you know, going solo, doing things on your own. How did that happen? I know you had like a lot of relationships, you know, from business school, from undergrad, from work, but that first deal is always the hardest in my opinion. So how was it for you?
Yeah, it is. It's super hard, very uncomfortable. And what's awesome, you just like nailed it, because I've gone back and done like a forensic analysis of like where are the opportunities came from. Mm-hmm. And like I made, it's not an attractive looking PowerPoint, so I don't show it to people, but I try to like line them all up. And basically it's either prior job, university, or graduate school. is where everything came from in the beginning. Now, once you get into it, they start like one will, you'll keep doing stuff with the same people over time. But the first one was like, my job had blown up at AIG. I was like super depressed. I ended up sort of like taking a sabbatical because I had plenty of money in the bank. So I was like, my problem isn't money right now. My problem is like, I have no sense of what I'm supposed to do with my life and I'm paralyzed. And so one of my very closest friends from my first job out of college, like he was like, come stay with me on the left west coast for like a couple of days. Let me like see, I'm working on a project. You can get involved. It's like, all right. So he's like, I'll give you some shares in the thing. I'll give you a share of any revenue produced. And so I went to work with him on this project that was working with YouTube influencers. This was in like 2011. So like this was in its infancy, right? YouTube was kind of still
early.
Super early. Like the idea of an influencer, people were like, we would, you know, we came up with this project to get influencers to like basically promote things on their YouTube pages. And we got like, it's a long story, but basically like through my networking and his network and whatever, he had the technology. We ended up selling some products to like, we did a deal with Smirnoff where my friend was like in new product development. And so I'd never sold anything in my life. And when I did, I was like, wow, I can sell something. It's incredible. So I made a little money. We ended up doing some deals with like, you know, this singer called Dragonette and like this like DJ and like all this crazy stuff. And anyway, it was kind of a mess, but, and it was very much fake it till you make it, but it went okay. And then, you know, he by giving me shares in the company, you know, it was the first time I'd become an advisor, which means you get shares for your time. You know, it's like you become, it's called sweat equity. He gave me like 1% of the company. And then it never really took off, but he ended up like basically buying my shares back for a couple $1,000s. So I didn't become a millionaire, I became a thousandaire, but it showed me what you could do. And then after that, I put that on my LinkedIn. And then anytime I'd meet a company, I would start to say, well, you know, I did this with this company and I got us a deal with Smirnoff. And then they would like say, wow, do you want to get involved? So that's how I did it. And I have to say, I was not like, I was so afraid. I don't even like, I look back, I was like, I don't know if I should do this. He's like, dude, there's no risk. Like I'm giving you shares in my company. All you have to do is like try to help me get some business. And I just was so in the mindset of being like an employee that I didn't know how to do it, but it was so easy once I got going. And then after that, like, boom, had a million.
That's amazing. And can you talk about deal flow too? Because I mean, you are a venture capitalist, you are connecting with so many different people. I mean, you're in New York City, your relationships. First question I want to ask, how much deals are you looking at per week? And then secondly, what's your investment strategy around some of the deal flow that you get?
Yeah. Okay. So first of all, I'd say, yes, right now I have so much deal flow. So I'm going to tell you, and you're going to be like, well, easy for you, Patrick, to do the stuff you do because you have so much deal flow. I see at least 7 a week.
Golly.
I mean, I don't even know. Does that math make sense? Maybe it's too much. Maybe like 4 a week. Okay. That was way too much. But when I started doing this, I was out of the VC game. So I had no deal flow. And the stuff you start to see in the beginning when you start to generate is like just not good. Like, but it's okay. You sort of, it's kind of like dating. You have to go on a bunch of those dates just to be able to realize like what is quality.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's true.
Some people might not like that answer, but I completely agree with that.
Yeah. It's sort of like you meet with a bunch of entrepreneurs. You maybe become an advisor. Like in the beginning, I don't need to write checks to people. You know, I like to just become like, if it's really speculative, I'm just not going to write a check. I prefer to become an advisor, learn more about you, learn more about the company, or just get to know you, spend more time with you. There's all kinds of ways to get involved without investing cash, right? And so in the beginning, that's how I did it. I just called people, hey, do you know of any opportunities? I hung out with entrepreneurs. I'd go to entrepreneurial networking events. And over time, and I invested in a fund, like a kind of an accelerator that was generating tons of companies a year. And that was the best source of, I invested a little bit of money, like $12,500, and I helped them out on the side. So they gave me another $12,500 in sort of like sweat equity. So I had $25,000 investment, and that generated me like 5 of the first deals I did. So that was really good. Now, how does it work today? Well, you know, like as much as, so angel investing is not a, unless you're like retired and you know, you're like really rich, it is not a job. right? It doesn't generate income for like a decade, which is something I did not appreciate. So I thought I'd like be an angel investor somehow, like something would hit and I'd just be like, that could be a career. No, you wake up one day and you're like, oh my God, like 13% or whatever. I don't even know the numbers, but like a large percentage of my net worth is like in long-term liquid high-risk deals. You don't want to be there, right? 10% yeah. entrepreneur for a reason, right? And so when I hit my like 20% or whatever that number was, I was like, well, this is not sustainable. I can't keep writing checks because even my successful deals will take 8 years. Like my most successful deal, which is going to be incredible, I've been in it since 2012. And so what I learned to do now is I have my investment portfolio that I do direct deals. I now am an investor in a fund with other angels where we can do it all together. Mm-hmm. And then I'm also a partner in a VC fund in Latin America, and I invested in that. So I get invest in portfolios of early stage deals. And then once in a while, if I see something really special, I'll invest personally, or I'll just be an advisor and get free equity. So that's kind of how I do it these days, because I can't stress this enough. Like when you are investing in early stage, high risk deals, like you don't want to choose just one because like it's so binary. You want to build a portfolio. And if you don't have like unlimited cash, you want to have a budget for how much you can do each year and have a long-term plan, because it's like anything else. If you look at the deals, I've done probably 10 direct equity investments, you know, buying shares in companies. Two of them have gone on to become unicorns. Like six of them have been total disasters, and a couple, like, we don't know yet. Yeah. That's like very typical.
And that's kind of like a bunch of my friends in the VC space, they say, if you're batting like that batting average, it's like 2 out of 10, 3 out of 10, and you're actually like all-star.
Yeah.
So understanding, like you said, diversifying and, you know, kind of hedging your risk. I love that. And from the athlete perspective, you know, the ways to get into deals without having to invest money. I think you hit the nail on the head. And I really enjoy that you said that, because a lot of times, I don't want to say athletes are getting bamboozled saying like you have to invest, you know, minimum 25K or 100K to get in this deal. And like there's other ways to get in, whether it's sweat equity, advisorship, you know, getting other people to raise money for that company. There's so many different ways to get involved. And I appreciate you sharing that.
I just want to comment on that. Sorry to interrupt, but this is...
No, you're good.
So I remember when I first started investing, people would be like, I really want you to be an investor in my company. I remember this one, I was in Brazil, great entrepreneur, although this company did not pan out, but he was awesome. So convincing, so competent, great track record. He's like, I just want you in my deal. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, man, what's your minimum? He's like 50K. I'm like, I will give you 5K.
Yeah.
He was like, deal. And so, you know, it's just like this whole thing around minimums is, it's so fake. Uh-huh. Like if somebody, you know, it's such BS. Like I have so many friends who have put 5 or 10K into a deal. When somebody tells you 50K is your minimum, there's a great story. Dick Costolo, who was eventually the CEO of Twitter, was approached to be an early investor in Twitter. And they were like, how much do you want to put? 50, 100? He's like, I'm good with 25. And by the way, 25K investment in Twitter, that becomes like 11 million bucks or 20 million. I don't even know the number. Like, you don't,
yeah.
If it's a hit, it'll be a hit. You'll make plenty of money.
Yeah. I appreciate you butting in and saying that. Like, that's important. You know, you are what you negotiate. And if you don't ask, you don't get.
Oh, I like that.
When it comes to FOMO, I mean, you coined the term. Deal flow athletes, what are some things that they need to, like, how can you combat FOMO? You know, as an athlete, you're a competitor, you're naturally greedy, you always want more. And then you got like the locker rooms, like, oh, I got into this deal, or I'm doing that brand sponsorship. How do you like stay even keel to your own path, you know, using your FOMO principles and, you know, philosophy?
First of all, I would say as athletes, you are in an amazing position because you are FOMO generators more than anything else. So like there's this great book by Robert Cialdini. I don't know if you've come across him, Amobi.
No, I'm not.
I wrote a book called Influence, but if you want just you can get the Cliff Notes version by, he came on my podcast like 2 months ago. He wrote this book called Influence. It sold 7 million copies. It's a very large book, okay? I'm not gonna like sugarcoat this thing. It's like the longest book I have ever had on my show. And so it's like I could throw it at you and you probably like end up, you'd be, you know, out for the season. But but he talks about the seven levers of influence. And like two of the levers are social proof, which is like athletes have social proof. It's like everybody wants to be you. And then like being good looking, and like athletes are generally pretty good looking people. So like you already naturally have the ability to influence people, and your platforms and stuff. Like if you build platform, that's powerful too, right? So that's just a good thing. Like you have something that a lot of people don't have, which is really powerful. That being said, you're right. Like I can only imagine if you're, I mean, it's such a, it's so competitive. It's like any other sort of like elite sort of group of people where you, and you know, I invented the word FOMO when I was a student at Harvard Business School, because I was surrounded by like people like me who were ambitious and successful in type A. And so, you know, you're constantly comparing yourself and having reference anxiety. It's like, well, this person just got, you know, a better deal, or they got this opportunity and I didn't, and therefore I suck and whatever. So that is not a place you want to be. How do we overcome that FOMO? Well, if we think about the definition of FOMO, FOMO is an anxiety created by the perception that something better is happening than what you're doing right now, combined with a fear of being excluded from a positive group experience, okay? So it's about ambition. It's about like, I perceive this great thing is out there and I want it, I'm ambitious, combined with a fear of being excluded or wanting to be part of the herd, right? And so what I encourage people to do when they feel the FOMO is like, first of all, acknowledge it. Like, okay, I'm feeling it right now. Like I am feeling jealous. I feel FOMO, I want that for me. But then start digging into like the perception question, which is like, okay, it looks great. Like, is this even possible for me? Like, do I even have time for this? You know, what would I have to give up for this? Sort of just think critically about like that thing. How much money would I really make? That's another one. I mean, a lot in the world of influencers and stuff like that, what looks great on paper, like me, or it sort of looks great on the Instagram, when you really get into the details, like there's no money in it, right? And so that's really important. And even if, you know, say like your friend's making investments and, you know, it's like, do you have the money? If you don't, like, make a plan, right? And so I think that's really critical. And then about the herd part of it, it's like, well, fine, like everybody's doing this, but like, do I want to do this? Cause I want to do this, this partnership. Does that really make sense for me? And, or is it like more like, I just don't, you know, I'm competitive and I want to be part of the group. And so as you think about that, sometimes you will realize, no, I really want to do this thing. Great. FOMO can be an incredible motivator, incredible motivator. So then make a plan to stop dreaming about it and actually make it happen in your real life. So I think it's really critical to just recognize FOMO is based on emotions, not facts. So when you want to overcome FOMO, you have to remove the emotions, put the facts in. It's like anything else in the things you do. Like it can be really, you can have big dreams. I want to be the Olympic star. I want to be this or that. Great. Train. You know, you're not just going to show up. Yeah. Right. And so like train. And like athletes are so well positioned for success because they understand the grit that it takes to get there.
No, I love that. And, you know, all the qualities you talk about when it comes to overcoming FOMO, I feel like it translates into money management, personal finance, you know, and that's something that you're very experienced in. So can you talk about that from the standpoint of like, you know, personal finance is a behavioral problem as well as a financial literacy problem, as well as, you know, exposure and just, I don't want to say lack of making money, but talk about like ways to, you know, how do you solve for this in the standpoint of like, the living like the Joneses term.
Yeah. So first of all, you're so right. I mean, the in the new book, the Fear of Missing Out book, I write all about the power of FOMO in terms of investing. And it's not just like you and me and like, it's like big, big money management firms, the people who are investing in like Theranos, right? These are supposed to be like the smartest people in the country and the world. And they're investing in a company that's like smoke and mirrors, right? So it happens all the time. Right now, because of, I mean, there's so many things happening in the world of personal finance that are so fascinating to me around the term of FOMO, meme stocks.
Yeah, that's, I was wanted to get into that. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I mean, it is crazy. Dogecoin. I my brother like bought a little Dogecoin and likes to talk about it with me, which I love my brother. But like, I don't want to talk about Dogecoin with you because I'm not,
you're not in the Reddit group chats.
No. And like, listen, I'm not going to ever play video games with my money, which is what you do when you're trading like that. Like, I'm not saying, by the way, I'm not saying don't play a little bit because it's fun and you can learn. That's fine. But these things are designed to create addiction in people. Like Robinhood, the app, just like any other social media app, is based to create addictive behavior so that you spend more and more time there to generate more and more money for them. They're not in it. They don't care about you. They care about them. And they are designed to basically control more and more of your mind share. And so that's why you see people who have no business investing in these highly speculative things, like losing all their money, spending all their time on it. They're like addicted, like gamblers. You don't have to go to Vegas anymore. It's so super destructive. Like they're taking their stimulus checks and just like plowing into Dogecoin. And so I would say, I mean, that I just did a little rant for you there about how I feel, but I would say when it comes to personal finance, again, I think a great rule of thumb is take 10% and do whatever the heck you want with it. You want to take 10% of your money and go into Dogecoin, like have at it. Like who am I to tell you not to, but limit it there. Be diversified, you know, have a sensible diversification strategy where you have long-term investing, where you're planning on, you know, sort of like you part in cash, you do some speculative stuff, you have like stocks and bonds, just do that. Because I think that the meme stock economy, it's just, I think it's like, just shows like a deeper sort of a series of issues in our society, and it not going to end well. Like find me a financial bubble that ended well. Some people win. Yeah. If you get in early, and all the fools follow you, yeah, and you sell out, great. But I mean, that is, you know, that's a perfect scenario. So many other people get hurt.
No, that's a great point that you made. You said something about like Robinhood and these new apps. You said a social media app, and that gun just like, I'm in my head, I'm like, damn, you're right. Like people every morning, like I'll be in the locker room, like, yo, check out Robin, check out, and like stocks. And before I just keep going on, disclaimer, this is not financial advice that me and Patrick are talking about. So make sure you consult with your team. Make sure you consult with your team. But you're not supposed to be on a stock app every day, all, you know, 24 hours a day, like you said. And like that whole, like, it's a social media app. I really enjoy that perspective, because it's making me think differently about like, all right, should I really be looking at my stock? Like it can only change so much over the course of a day or course of a week, course of a month. So having that like long-term strategy.
And by the way, I don't mean to be like some like bitter, I'm not trying to be like all, you know, uptight or, you know, negative. That's not what I don't want to sound like some like curmudgeonly person. That's not what I'm saying at all. But what I'm saying is like, when you go back to like 1929, there was like some famous quote, like JP Morgan or somebody, I don't remember who exactly, but they're like, you know, I knew the market was in trouble today because like the guy who was shining my shoes was telling me which stocks to buy. Because, and I'm not dissing on people who shine shoes. What I'm saying is like, he's not like, that person isn't doing like deep research. And I think, you know, like I was talking to my brother and he's like, well, what does it matter? Like it's all a casino anyway. And I'm like, well, that is not the case. Like there are businesses that have like earnings, and you can analyze them and you can like do, you can like project them forward. And then there are just speculative assets that trade based on emotion and Reddit. And those are different things, and don't conflate them. That's all I'm saying. So, you know, I don't want to say again, like, I just, you know, it's just, to me, it's just like, cause it's not going to end well. Come back to this in a year.
No, respect. Okay. Perfect. So I want to talk about like switching gears a little bit, you know, 10% entrepreneur, FOMO, sapiens, FOMO. You've done a great job of building out your portfolio, not only from the VC standpoint and the opportunity standpoint, but the making money standpoint. You know, you've written a book that's led to speaking engagements, courses that you've done, and your podcast. Can you talk about like building that from the ground up and like how you're getting these guests now? How do you manage that? You know, the concept of writing a book, publishing, deals, negotiating, all that.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. And you know, I didn't even think I'd be doing these. This was not in the plan, by the way, everybody. So like never know what the world's going to give you. My plan was to just like be on Wall Street and that was it. And then, well, things changed. And so, which is so good because it's so, I'm so much happier. I used to watch friends of mine. There's a guy called Andy Dunn who started this company called Bonobos, which you may have heard of.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So Andy's like, he's not a close friend or anything. I just know him in New York. But, you know, I remember he was running that company and I felt super jealous. Like, I'll never have, like, he's like, that guy walks in the room. He is this company. Like he is Bonobos. I'll never have that. Like, what am I going to talk about? And then this FOMO thing happened and the other stuff. And it's like, I now have that and it's awesome. It's like better than money in a lot of ways, but you got to have the money too. And so I would say what I have realized is, number one, everything I do supports, like there's nothing I do that's like way out in left field. Everything I do is part of a portfolio that where everything is sort of self-reinforcing. So the work I do on the podcast informs the things that I do in my books and my speaking, my investment activities as an investor give me great ideas for my podcast. My podcast gives me great ideas for investment. So it's all kind of like symbiotic, I guess, like an ecosystem. In terms of, you know, build, like especially content businesses, like when you start to realize when you do this is like, it's hard to monetize content. It's super hard. And like living off of content alone is like, it's not easy. And so, you know, what I've done is, you know, the books are interesting because, you know, like they're far less, you make a lot less money than I think people imagine that you do. But if you do a book that can be successful across the world and you start selling foreign rights, like my books come out in like 12 languages, each one of those times you publish in a foreign country, you create a revenue stream going forward. You get an initial payment and revenue stream. So like I'm 5 years into my first book came out in 2016. I still get checks for that from like Mexico and Korea and whatever. That's A. B is speaking. It's very lucrative if you're, you know, a sort of in-demand speaker. You do a couple of speeches a year and you're like, holy moly. So the books are create sort of like a long tail sort of growth funnel for speaking. And speaking you can't predict, at least, you know, until you get in. Some people speak 300 days a year. I'm not interested in being on the road like that. But even with the pandemic, it just all it's like shifted to Zoom. So you're like sitting in your apartment, you give like an hour long speech and like, it's based on all this work you've done. So, you know, you've earned the money. It's like, you know, but it's, you're sort of like, wow, this is a really awesome, people are paying me to listen to what I have to say. And it's, they're paying me well. So I love doing that. And I speak from conferences, you know, the Pet Distributors Association to Wall Street firms, to universities, to you name it.
Any advice on like how to become a great professional speaker, public speaker?
Yeah. I mean, and actually in terms of the speaking itself, the big thing, okay. Number one is you need to learn how to be a speaker. So I've been speaking since I was a kid. I used to compete in like speech competitions.
Oh, unfair advantage.
Little Patrick. Yeah, but you know, that was different. It was very, I don't know, I was like 13. So, you know, nobody's gonna pay for that. What I think doing media, getting a media training person, number one, like I actually have I found a woman who did training with me about just basically good public speaking is being yourself plus 20%. Mm-hmm. You know? And I think a lot of us, when we speak, we adopt a persona of somebody who's different. That's not what you want to do. You want to just be you, but a little bit more engaging. So trainers can help you with that. Number two, though, the most important thing is you need somebody to help you to learn how to tell a story. So I had a guy who worked with me, like with my first book, I used to do this presentation. It was so boring. Like it was the most boring thing ever. And I dressed like I was like a business school professor. And this guy was like, no, like make it fun. Throw some like GIFs in there. You know, all those fun, ask questions, take a poll, you know, make it interactive, stuff like that. So there are people who know how to do that. I did like a TED talk and they taught me a ton about that too. But I would say there are people out there, like I would go find somebody who's an actor or a screenwriter or a playwright or a, you know, just like get them to teach you and then watch a bunch of good people who are like, watch people who are good at it and see how they do it. There's a lot of tricks of the trade, like asking questions, making it interactive. It's all, you know, it's like anything else. It's like learning how to play a sport. You know, you watch like, if you watch enough, like Cristiano Ronaldo, who by the way, I don't really like, Leo Messi, Batistuta, you can copy them.
That's true. I like that last girl, Batistuta, man. Okay.
My favorite is Diego Forlan.
Okay. Yeah. Respect. Nice. Yeah. No, but appreciate the speaking engagement advice because, like, I think that's a lane that athletes still aren't tapping into enough.
Oh, my God.
Like, people with their story.
And
I just got recently asked to do a speaking engagement. And quick story, I had no idea how to negotiate. I was like, we were playing, like, cat and mouse. I was like, what's your budget? They're like, what do you charge? I was like, what's your budget? They're like, what are your charge? And like, just understanding like the tricks of the trade.
I'm going to tell you my secret after we tape. I have a very powerful secret on this front, but I'm not going to tell the public because why would you give away your number one secret?
Yeah.
I will say, by the way, the other thing to think about is when you're working on a speech, know your audience. Like some audiences don't pay and others do. Like, you know, universities pay.
Mm-hmm.
High schools don't. You know what I mean? So like corporate can pay a lot. So, you know, if you focus your speech on corporate audiences, your ability to monetize is much higher than if you're focusing on nonprofits. And maybe you want to do nonprofits and that's your passion and like have at it. But there's definitely like a lot of stuff around market segmentation too.
Oh, I love that. No, that's amazing. Yeah. I feel like you're doing a lot of different things, but like you said, you have it all organized and it's all filling to the funnel of what you want to do. And I think a lot of athletes could take note to that as they continue to blossom in their careers off the field as well. No, I don't want to take up too much of your time, but last question. You've spoken with a lot of different athletes, a lot of different entertainers, celebrities. When it comes to entrepreneurship, what is more important, the skill or is it understanding like the market that they're getting into?
I think, to be honest with you, the most important thing is finding people who you trust that you can work with.
I love that.
You know what I mean? Because you have skill. Mm-hmm. You have a really special skill that is valuable and other people have skills that are complementary to you. And so finding those people, you're just going to be a lot more effective.
I think that's really important because as athletes, we want to do everything ourselves, even though we're like so used to working in a team environment, we like to take on that burden. So understanding how to delegate, how to find the right partners to fill the needs that, you know, maybe you're not as good at, and then finding your role within a team, I think is really important.
And by the way, what you need to stay away from though, and I think this is a real temptation with athletes because people are trying to get stuff from you all the time, right?
Yeah.
People are like, you know, people are trying to, you know, they think they, in their, you know, in their head, they're like, this is a very successful person. And so I imagine, and you see it with like, you hear these stories of managers who take advantage of their clients and all kinds of stuff. But there may be, you might have a bias to like, I'm going to work with people I know really well, my cousin, my brother, my best friend from growing up. But if they don't know what they're doing either, then, you know, that's bad. And so simply trusting somebody isn't good enough. You need somebody who is competent.
Yeah.
That's really important. And so that's why it's great to start small, because if you do a bunch of different projects with different people, you can see who's good and then you can move forward from there.
No, I love that. So, you know, for the audience that may want to connect with you, maybe find out that your number one secret when it comes to
I'm telling you with no doubt.
Yeah. Okay, perfect. How can they connect with you? How can they find your books? I know we're going to have all the information in the show notes, and then any lasting quote or thing that you want to share with the audience.
Sure. Well, so the best way to find me, and I love hearing from you, and I, you know, I do write back, is
he does. That's facts, because I remember when I read the book and I was like, he had his information on the back page. I was like, I'm gonna reach out to him, and within a week I was like, what? And I had to like, yeah, it was funny. That was good.
I know.
Thank you so much.
People are like, wait, I've had people say like, you're very responsive, like, do you not have a lot to do? And I'm like, no, I do, but I care. And I actually like learned so much from you, and like a guy like you, like, look what you're doing. Like these years later, like now we're back together again, doing something.
Yeah.
So it's cool. So you can email me at letsconnect@patrickmcginnis.com. My website is patrickmcginnis.com. My Instagram is at Patrick J. McGinnis. If you use Twitter, it's at PJ McGinnis. And then the podcast, which you can find, you know, in all the places, is FOMO Sapiens. It's two words. And the podcast for the podcast website is FOMOSapiens.com. So I just overwhelmed you. And if you're interested more in 10% Entrepreneur, I actually did a course, an audio course, like podcast format with Himalaya, which is a podcasting app, like a learning app. So Himalaya.com/part-time, you get a free subscription. You can actually take the course for free. So you just use the code part-time.
Thank you so much. And also to note, if you follow him on Twitter or Instagram or any of those social platforms, don't follow, then unfollow to say that Patrick is following you, because he will unfollow you again. but thank you so much, Patrick. It was a pleasure. It's always a pleasure to connect with you. Next time in New York, we're definitely going to have to get together, but I appreciate you making the time and look forward to keeping in touch with you.
Thank you so much. It's so good seeing you.
Thank you for tuning in to this podcast episode. For more information, check out the show notes and go to our website, www.afrugalathlete.com. If you enjoyed, please leave a favorable rating and review and share and subscribe. Thank you so much.